The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. 3 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 9th of September, 2026. You're very welcome along to the programme. We've got a packed show for you over the next 2 hours to keep you informed and entertained and involved. We want you to text, call, email, whatever you want to do. Our email is comments at highlandradio.com. You can give us a call on 07491 25000, or text or WhatsApp 086 60 25000. And the WhatsApp, by the way, is good for you to send in your voice message as well. Maybe that will suit you for a myriad of reasons. If you want to watch the show, if you're at home on the big TV, your Fire Stick, YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch us across your mobile devices on YouTube, Facebook, and on the X platform. So we are literally stalking you. There's no way you can escape. We are there. Right now, oh, we mentioned just before 9 o'clock about the NTAs. Part of my disinterest in the NTAs, like I used to be more interested in it, is because I don't watch a ton of scheduled TV anymore, right? So if you don't have a favourite show on telly per se, you're not going to take as much interest. But now I've got more interest because I forgot now, here at Highland Radio, mixing with the big wigs, we have an interest in the NTAs. I didn't realise, and a big congratulations to our own Danny O'Carroll. Mrs Brown's Boys has won Best Comedy at the NTAs. It picked up that award last night. The Brendan O'Carroll sitcom took the prize at a ceremony held at London's O2, and it beat off some fantastic opposition. Last One Laughing is a huge show. It beat that. Amanda Land, Changing Ends, and Not Going Out, another massive one. And it's just another NTA comedy win for Brendan and the family, and that long-running sitcom, because they've taken the award several times. So well done to Danny and Brendan. I heard Danny reference Brendan obviously had to defer some shows and had to undergo an operation, and I heard him on with Anya last week saying that, or was it earlier this week, saying the operation went really, really well, better than expected, which is good. Okay, so well done to Danny, Brendan and the whole family there. I'm more interested now all of a sudden. Right, let's have a look at some of the newspapers today. The Finn Valley Voice: Killigordon firm shows London diaspora how it is done. Two Killigordon firms hit London in style this week at Donegal County Council's Fireside Chat diaspora event. Monday's event, said Councillor Gary Doherty, was designed to strengthen our connection with the diaspora and showcase the wealth of opportunities that exist across our communities and businesses. That would have been an interesting event, actually, I think. Right, on to the national newspapers today. We're being softened up for the inevitable, folks. The Taoiseach has said 2 euro diesel will be a new norm. Last time we heard new norm, we weren't too pleased about it, were we? Steep diesel prices, which exceed 2 euro a litre at some filling stations, are the new norm, the Taoiseach has warned. His comments come as Fuel for Ireland, which represents fuel firms, confirmed diesel has risen above 2 euro in some forecourts around Donegal, in fact, as well. Backbench TDs have called on the government to do as much as possible to shelter people from the costs, with one saying the increase can become like another mortgage each month, especially for those in rural Ireland who have to drive long distances for work. But one minister told the Irish Daily Mail yesterday that their cabinet colleagues are spending as if it's 2007, adding this is a crash, that a crash is inevitable at this point, which I actually would agree, and I'm kind of half prepping myself for that. We cannot, it's like you're constantly inflating a balloon, and there comes a point globally where it's going to have to pop, and I just feel we're getting very close to that. State established energy expert group, the National Energy Affordability Task Force, has advised that prices could rise and stay, let's go to page six, could stay above the 2 euro mark. Now, the reality is that there is only a certain amount of latitude the government has. I mean, there is quite significant discounts on diesel at the moment through the measures they've introduced, back over 2 euro. Donald Trump has got himself into an absolute state in the Middle East. He can't get out of it. It's very, very difficult for him. And Iran have him exactly where they would want him. Our only hope is alternative pipelines, and they are being worked on. You know, alternative ways. There's so much money in oil. The oil companies are actively trying to find ways of getting their product out of the Middle East that doesn't use the Strait of Hormuz. That's going to take a while to filter through. And as I say, you know, I'm not a spokesperson for the government by any stretch. There is a limit to how much of that blow can be softened for us. But it's going to become increasingly, and it is becoming increasingly expensive, particularly to live in rural Ireland, because we have no alternatives. We don't, well, I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. Local Link has been great and is great for many people, but I'm on about sort of the day-to-day, right? If you're in Dublin, there's many options to get to and from work, especially if work's at different times. We don't have those here. So speaking of new norms, it's funny that there's this almost, is it a stubborn acceptance of the traffic situation in Letterkenny now? We were talking about 100 points that students would be starting off with and being deducted for being late at school. It's an absolute nightmare for people getting people around Letterkenny between kids being late for school, kids being late for creche, people being late for hospital appointments. And it does seem to be that there is a kind of a new norm of traffic creeping in because people are peed off. But there's this, as I say, sort of almost like a reluctant acceptance that is this the way it's going to be? So there's a few new norms sitting burning diesel in and around Letterkenny. But what can be done to help those less well off? Well, it's not going to be an increase in children's allowance, but it's not all bad news potentially. There'll be no increase to the children's allowance in next month's budget, meaning the payment will remain the same as it has been for the past decade. Taoiseach Micheál Martin has signalled the coalition will favour targeted supports to alleviate cost pressures on families. Warnings made to the government that high energy prices and diesel rates above 2 litre a euro, as I mentioned, will be the new norm, has meant that measures to alleviate fuel prices will have to be factored into budgetary considerations. Coalition sources have told the Irish Independent there will be no room for an increase in the children's allowance, which was last raised in budget 2016 by €5 to €140 a month per child. Now, all children need to be treated equal. Everyone gets the children's allowance, but if you're a billionaire, you get it. If you're in the below the poverty line, you get it. I've kind of always been in favour of finding ways, I'm not saying better off people shouldn't get it, but finding ways to help those that need it most, but also to make sure that it's those that need it most that you're helping and that the system's not being exploited or anything. Staying with the newspapers, of course, the Irish Times now. Teenagers in Ireland are getting significantly lower scores in reading and maths than they were a decade ago, according to international research. The trend of decline, particularly in reading, is seen across more than 90 countries. Researchers described the findings as sobering. I don't know why this isn't. And this is there anything here in that multiple classrooms, right? So I really think that it's difficult for any teacher to teach four different classes at the same time. And I know that's at primary. But also, too, I wonder how, and maybe this isn't a problem, but say, for instance, in Donegal, you know, we would have got a lot of people into schools, secondary schools for that matter, that English wouldn't be their first language or they might be struggling with English. And I wonder how, as a teacher in secondary school, you make sure that they get a good education, but also keep up the standard of, you know, the native English speakers in that scenario. Is there any possibility, and maybe it couldn't be, that it would have this level of effect? Is there any possibility that that teachers and schools trying to find different ways to teach lots of people at different abilities is actually bringing the average down? I don't think that's incredibly controversial. It's quite basic, isn't it, if you're trying to make sure that everyone's at the same pace, inevitably, do you not maybe slow things down a little bit as you try and bring things up at the same time for those who maybe are learning English at the same time? Because we did had an awful lot of people move here and are beginning to integrate and all that type of stuff from Ukraine who perhaps didn't speak fantastic English. I don't know. I'm just spitballing. But if we are seeing a downward trend in the ability to read and teach maths, I'm just wondering, is that a factor? Could that be a factor? I don't know. And that's not in any way a criticism of people coming here or what have you. It's just maybe an observation as we struggle to find out what's going on there. Because that has a consequence then in terms of grades in third level qualifications then going into the workforce more broadly. Big controversies in and around the GEA. We're looking to get some reaction on this for you. Fuming, Dr. Mary McAleese has blasted the GEA after quitting as chairperson of the Integration Committee. And the former president of Ireland said she suspected some people are not entirely happy about the idea of including women in decision-making at the top level of Gaelic sports. Now, I was curious about this, and I was looking at the top table in the GEA, and there's about 19 or 20 of them, and close on half of them are women, but maybe she's talking about something more specific. McAleese admits being absolutely devastated that the GEA has rolled back on plans to integrate with the Ladies Gaelic Football Association and Camogie Association. The three bodies had committed to achieving integration by 27 and had agreed to hold special congresses next month in order to enable the creation of one membership of one association from April of next year. However, the GEA wrote to the group on Monday requesting time to pause and reflect on the process. The GEA told the steering group that it wished to reconsider the approach with greater focus on equity rather than equality. It's understood the GEA's proposal was to extend the process by up to 5 years and that they remain fully committed to integration. And Mrs. McAleese has pulled them up on questions in relation to financing and other elements of the process. She's of the view that the Integration Committee had addressed any of those concerns that were out there, and the GEA has to some extent overlooked their work to say we need more time, or this is a problem, that's a problem. So that is going to be that's going to be deferred. Did you watch or do you watch The Voice? Tom Jones is out, which is quite sad, and he's still wonderfully talented and active, of course. Music icon Tom Jones has blasted ITV for giving him the boot from The Voice at the age of 86. The furious Welsh legend says he was still raring to go, but bosses decided there would be no longer be a chair for him. Tom said he was only recently told he'd lost his place on the hit talent show with financial difficulty with insurance, given as the reason. Okay, that's quite worrying, isn't it? And the defiant sex bomb singer hit back, there's never a good time. Sorry, that's Scottish. There's never a good time to fire an 86-year-old who's still pretty good at his job. Okay, there you go. I thought he was very good on that show, any clips that I saw of it. Now, clinical psychologist Dr. David Coleman has announced his 2026 nationwide tour, and it's going to kick off in Hungarian on Theatre in Letterkenny next month, the 6th of October. To be more precise, Ready for Anything, Building Emotional Resilience in Teenagers, in Children and Teenagers is the focus of it. Good morning to you, David. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. Just to clarify, it's actually Thursday the 8th of October that I'm going to. It is, in fact, the start of the tour, but it's going to be Thursday the 8th that I'm up in Hungarian on.
Okie doke, we'll send that back to the press company because they've given me the wrong date here. It's just in the preamble. It's correct, actually, in the list of dates. Okay, so that's the 8th. We'll remind people at the end. Before we get to that, if you don't mind, and some of the things we've been talking about, we got a notification from a parent yesterday about a new system that has been employed in the school their child goes to, where they start off with 100 points. And you know, if they are late or they're a bit tardy with their homework or any other infractions, the numbers are reduced. There is also provision to sort of build those numbers back up. Just from a child psychologist's point of view, what do you think of those types of ideas?
I think it's always a tricky one, Greg, because, I mean, we know with any kind of a reinforcement system, whether it's a negative reinforcement system, which is where essentially you're being punished for any wrongdoing, or a positive one where you're getting some kind of reward for doing the right thing, you know, they have a limited lifespan. And so every reinforcement system eventually runs out of rope. And so what might be very reinforcing, so you might have a youngster, for example, who is very keen to hold their 100-point score at the start, you know, start to lose 5 points for this, 10 points for that. Suddenly they're down to 85 points, and then they're down to 75 points. And then they go, well, what's, you know, I just don't even care anymore. And so what can happen then is that you have a child who just isn't, you know, kind of bought into the system, and so the system loses its effectiveness, and so that's one issue I think that can happen. I think you have another issue then with, you know, it needing to be really clear what the points lost, if you like, is for each kind of infraction, because if you have it that a teacher has a kind of a can just choose how many points get taken off depending on, you know, the time of day, their mood, the particular child, then it becomes a very unfair system. So it just needs to be really clear if you are employing a system like that. I mean, I think, you know, the more important element for me is what you mentioned at the end of it, which is that there are opportunities for young people, children, to actually gain points. And so if that was the starting situation, you know, that it's all about trying to gain points, or that, you know, when you have a certain number of points, then you get a particular kind of reward. So maybe you get a night of homework off, for example, if you can, you know, garner 20 points in a week, depending again on what the points are given out for. Those kinds of systems tend to be more effective when children are working towards something, rather than a system that's only focused on taking things away from kids. Because I think kids feel a little bit resentful. They feel like, oh, this is just going to be, you know, unfairly administered. And again, it's about whether children are teenagers, depending on the school that's been brought in, whether they buy into it. Because, you know, if any system is going to work, the children themselves have to buy in and say, yeah, this is worth working with.
But David, sort of caregivers, you know, educators, we have to make sure when we do something, it is actually positive for the child. And I think that has to be absolute, if you know what I mean. I don't think there can be, personally speaking, in this space, especially in the formative years, wiggle room. And if it is too blunt an instrument, and you're talking of a school population potentially of 1,000, if it has the potential to be particularly detrimental to even a small cohort of those, then for me, it's not thoroughly thought through.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, no, like every school has to have, you know, some kind of system to maintain an element of law and order, so to speak, because, you know, I think, you know, children and teenagers, possibly even teenagers especially, you know, they're just developing and growing at such different rates and have such different needs. And so, you know, if schools didn't have any kind of system, then there'd be chaos, and you can't learn in a system of chaos either. So, you know, I mean, I do think, you know, it's tricky for schools to try to find a system that is universally positive, but also will have the effect of, you know, allowing teachers to teach in the classroom and having some way in which children can be encouraged to, you know, to actually focus, to actually stay quiet, to actually not be giddy, to actually, you know, do their homework, all those different things. And so it is, you know, it's a challenge one way or the other. And I, you know, I don't know that we can just say, oh, if it's bad for one child, then, you know, the system just shouldn't be in place.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. As long as, and it was a question rather than knowledge, is that, you know, as long as there's not a cohort that it falls away and it benefits the better students or what have you, or those that maybe their parents are better getting them into school because they've got better resources or whatever it might be. But I understand exactly what you're saying. And I'm also very interested in your views on, and I talk about this a lot on this program, probably to the annoyance of many listeners, is about how we ensure that we have children that are emotionally resilient by the time they get into third level or even beyond that and into the workforce. And I would speak to people, as I've mentioned on the show before today, in industry who are a little bit frustrated with new recruits, for an example, and their level of resilience just to be able to function in a basic authoritarian, not, you know, in a system of management, etc. So why are you focusing on building emotional resilience in children and teenagers? Is it just the next topic that you think is interesting, or is it a specific issue that you're seeing that you wish to help people on?
Well, I think one of the things that has certainly become more common is that I think parents are becoming more fearful of the world that their kids are growing up in. And one of the reactions to that is that parents can become protective and in some situations overprotective. And in many ways, we almost do too much for our kids. And one of the downsides of doing that is that they do lose that capacity to do things for themselves if we're doing everything for them. And it's only, I mean, it's a kind of a harsh situation, but it's only through suffering that we can build resilience. And so if your child has never suffered in any way, and I'm not talking about major suffering of, you know, kind of chronic illness or, you know, some accident happening to a child, but just the normal suffering, I suppose the example that best comes to mind is probably predates school meals for primary school children. But, you know, when parents used to provide the lunches for their child, if their child forgot a lunch, most parents will probably drive into the school to deliver a lunch that was left behind on the counter. And so in a situation like that, your child unfortunately learns nothing other than that mommy or daddy is willing to drive into the school at the drop of a hat to make sure that they don't feel in any way hungry. Whereas if it was the case that you left your child without their lunch and went, oh, that's a shame, they've forgotten their lunch, they're going to be hungry now, your child has to suddenly start to think. And so the first thing they're going to do is probably tell the teacher, oh, I've forgotten my lunch. The teacher would probably then say to the class, oh, okay, lads, you know, Johnny's forgotten his lunch. We've got to share with him. And so all the other kids go, brilliant. They pull out the rotten bananas and apples that have been at the bottom of their own school bags. And poor Johnny is left with, you know, lots of fruit that he probably doesn't even want to eat. But, you know, he's not going to die for sure in school day. But when he gets home, he's certainly going to be in a situation where he's learned, I need to be more careful and I need to remember to bring my lunch in. And so in a situation like that, you know, he's learning something through minor suffering. You know, it wasn't pleasant probably, you know, being hungry, and it wasn't pleasant having to get all the leftovers from other people's lunches. But he's now learned. And in that process, you can say, you know, so the next time, what do you need to do? And he go, oh, I just have to remember to bring my lunch. And you go, yeah, absolutely. You need to remember to bring your lunch. I'll always leave it in the same place. You always have to remember to put it into your school bag.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that then, it's that reflective process after your child has gone through something that was a bit difficult or a bit challenging that helps them build the resilience. But the resilience then stands to them so that the next time they're in a difficult situation, they realize that, you know, well, actually, I have some skills and strategies. I know I can go talk to an adult. I can talk to somebody who can help me, and I can resolve the situation. And so they feel empowered to actually do something for themselves, mm-hmm. rather than always feeling helpless and disempowered because mommy or daddy has always just stepped in and taken over and done everything for them.
I think moms and dads often struggle too with saying no. So in other words, a child wants to do this and well, no, you can't, we can't afford it, or it's too late, or you're too young. And a lot of children don't hear that too much. Is that part of this conversation as well? So in other words, they often get everything that they want, and if they don't get it, there's something to replace it, or sympathy, or I'm so sorry, or is that a are we dropping the ball in any regard there?
Well, I think if you never say no to your child, your child is going to ultimately be quite indulged. They're probably going to grow up feeling quite entitled, and that certainly will do them a disservice in the long term. And as you say, you have a young person who expects to get everything they want. They go into a working environment and realize that they've actually got to dance to somebody else's tune, to the company's tune, to their boss's tune, and they can't cope because they don't know how to do that. So I think it is really important that, not that we just say no to our kids for the sake of saying no, but if it's appropriate to say no, if we can't afford something, if it's not the right time for something and they want something, I think it's okay for us to say no. And what we then have to help them do, of course, is just manage the disappointment. And so that's the bit I think that sometimes we're reluctant to do. So that's sometimes why we don't say no, because we don't want the protest, we don't want the tears, we don't want the giving out, we don't want the constant whinging or whining or whatever it is that we expect will happen. But ultimately, you know, that happens because a child is disappointed. And so if we acknowledge the disappointment, then, you know, ultimately children learn how to deal with disappointment, which is a very good thing, because there will be probably plenty of times in their lives when they're going to be disappointed that something hasn't worked out the way it was intended to. And I think that's just another skill then that your child has has under their belt. And for sure, by the time they're grown up, you know, if they've been in situations where they realize that not everything comes their way, and that in fact the only reason things come their way is because they work hard for it, they're going to be in a much stronger position, I think, to cope with the ups and the downs of life. Because as we know, life is never linear. You know, there's always a few ups, things go well, and then there's a few downs, things don't go well, and children have to be ready for both.
One thing I've never sort of seen factored into this conversation in any of the conversations I've had, and maybe it's because it's not a factor, is the at a certain level the emotional intelligence of children and teenagers, i.e. that they are able to use their own skills and knowledge to emotionally manipulate us. So in other words, I think we often think of it's like the adult who has everything and the child who's this little vulnerable thing, or the younger person, and we're not factoring in the fact that they also can use skills that they have to get what they want.
Yeah, I mean, part of the development of emotional intelligence is being able to firstly recognize and name your own feelings. That's one of the starter skills in terms of the development of emotional intelligence. But then an additional skill is being able to recognize and understand other people's emotions. And so that's where empathy can start. But it is also then where that skill of being able to, I suppose, recognize somebody else's feeling and then moderate your own behavior or whatever it might be in order to elicit a particular kind of emotional response from somebody else. So you're right. I mean, in some ways, if kids get to the point that they can emotionally manipulate their parents, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it's a skill that they have. You just don't want them using it as their de facto or default setting when it comes to trying to get their own way.
And okay,
as a parent, we have to be able to, again, help them spot that that's what they're doing. It's like, oh yeah, look, you look really upset. I think you're actually so super upset because you're hoping that if you're really, really upset that I'm going to change my mind, that's going to be hard for you because I'm not going to change my mind in this occasion, even though you seem really upset. So
go ahead. I was going to ask you, before we remind people of the show, is part of the cycle we're in now is that we have maybe an increasing generation of adults who are parents that themselves actually still have a hangover of childhood anxiety and a lack of resilience. And you know, their concern for their children are, you know, perhaps beyond what they should be. In other words, if I say no, is my child going to harm themselves? I don't know how I could deal with that. So yeah, I'm feeling anxious myself, so I'm not going to do that. You know, and there's a bit of maybe toughness in this generation of parents, and maybe it might even worsen going forward, that we need to sort ourselves out, because we need to sort ourselves out as best we can to sort our and to help give our children their best chance.
Yeah, I do think over the years, you know, there's definitely been a shift where parents don't want their children to experience bad feelings, you know, challenging feelings, upsetting feelings. And I think some of that is because of the way the discourse has moved in terms of, you know, what's termed mental health. I mean, I never use the term mental health in my discussions. I do talk about children's emotional well-being, but never mental health, because I think one of the things that has happened as part of the discourse on mental health is that we've come to pathologize a lot of very normal feelings. And so it's almost like if a child feels sad, or if a child feels anxious, or if a child feels upset, or disappointed, that somehow that's, you know, mental some health. Kind of chronic illness
that's
that
they really, have, really important just... that, and I would love to see your approach to that, David, more broadly adopted, where everything is grouped into mental health. And you hear children talk of poor mental health when it, for me, it was an emotion or a feeling.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's important that kids get to experience the gamut of feelings through their childhood. And so they come to realize that every feeling will come and it will go, and that there are things that will make a feeling feel worse and more intense and more unpleasant, perhaps. And there are other things that will make it feel easier and better and less intense. And so that's just a very natural process. But for children and teenagers, often they need external support. They need their parents to be able to acknowledge feelings, empathize a lot with them, help them recognize that the feeling is there, help them recognize what that feeling is connected to, and from there then they can process the feeling, deal with it, and move on from it. And that is, you know, another skill that I think you perhaps we're shying away from as a bunch of parents, because as you say, I think sometimes we're afraid just to let our kids feel bad about anything, that it, that somehow it's a trauma for them if they just feel upset that they didn't get the thing that they wanted.
All right, you're coming off the back of the sellout tour in 2024. It's the new tour now, kicking off on the 8th of October in On Green On Theatre in Letterkenny. The show is for parents, adults, not for children or teens themselves. Now, as I say, it's a big old tour. Two nights in Dublin. We're going to focus on Derry. I was going to say we're going to focus on Letterkenny because that's where your show is. So, what is the format of the show? If you don't mind letting us know, David.
Yeah, no problem. So it is, as you say, it's a completely new tour. So last time I was in Letterkenny, I was talking all about anxiety. This time around, I'm talking about emotional resilience and how we can build it. So very much the themes that we were just talking about there. The plan for the evening will be that I'll be talking for about an hour or so, and then there's going to be an interval. And then after the interval, we're going to open the floor for audience questions and answers. And so that'll last for as long as there's enthusiasm to ask questions and I have the capacity to answer. Answers probably again, you know, 30-40 minutes of Q&A. So that's an opportunity as well. Even if building emotional resilience isn't the core of your questioning, if you have other questions you'd like to hear me try and get an answer to, by all means, come along anyway. So the tickets are available from On Green On's box office. So people can come, get those online, pop into the On Green On if you're in Letterkenny, or if you go to my webpage, davidcoleman.ie/tour, again, you'll see all the listed dates. But again, there's a link there to the On Green On ticket sales. So yeah, hopefully people will get to come along. I look forward to meeting everyone.
Well, I'm sure it will be wedged. Thank you so very much indeed. That's Dr. David Coleman. And we've another great guest for you, Professor Kevin Curran, Professor of Cybersecurity at Ulster University. Great to see you again. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Right. Now, Commissioner Mann has launched its first formal investigation into X under the Online Safety Code. It's over the potential ineffective implementation of age assurance mechanisms. So what is the background to this?
Yeah, they've opened it under two areas to probe. One is whether the age assurance is effective to keep children from seeing porn online or extreme violence. And secondly, whether the parental controls are effective and they meet the minimum functions, are easy to find and shown at sign-up time.
Now, they seem to be quite determined to hit them where these companies feel the pain most, and that's financially. X could be facing a very big sanction if it is found to be non-compliant.
Yeah, that's under GDPR. The same applies actually if companies are found to have data breaches, but up to 20 million or 4% of the global turnover is there. And it seems of late that the wind of change is blowing in the social platform space, that what platforms have got away with previously seems to be coming under a lot of scrutiny. And in this case here, because the concerns here are that X is one of the social media platforms that allows pornographic content, although it's off by default when you sign up. Like, for instance, I spend hours a day on X and I never see any explicit material. But the fact is that children, of course, still in Ireland can sign up to these platforms at the age of 13. So the worries are whether or not they're going to see this explicit content along with extreme, you know, violence or, you know, other things that we don't want any young people to see. And of course, whether or not X can do have vetted them properly to see that they are of a certain age. And X will claim, of course, that it does, that it looks to use different pointers to see whether someone is over, you know, of a certain age, under 18, obviously, that we're doing, because unfortunately, age assurance can be a can of worms within society, because, of course, that means because there is no clear fix to age assurance on the internet. The only way you can do it is to probe everyone for their age ID. And that means showing a government passport, a government ID, and going through, you know, lives, checks with your video feed, whatever else. And of course, that the platforms for one are against that, because of course that creates a barrier to people signing up for sites. And again, there is a cost involved in that. So there is no easy way of age assurance, but there are.
But does that not give the likes of X and Facebook X and Meta and other platforms and out here. In other words, you know, like this is up to legislators here. You know, introduce age verification, then we'll take the ID of everyone that uses these platforms, and then we can ensure that it's not a, it's I think it's more to prove you're over 18 rather than to prove you're not under 18. Yeah. Can they not throw that back and say, look, you're dragging your feet here, you know, in terms of giving us the actual tools that can guarantee as much as is possible under 18s don't access this material?
It seems to be one of the cards that most governments, even, you know, again, the stricter ones like Australia, have chosen not to brandish at this time because of the outfall, really, even politically from that, because some people are, again, are against any social creep or, you know, any mission creep of any sort. In other words, if it's done on this platform, it could be done in any, and that means that we don't have any anonymity online or whatever else, and you can seem like Big Brother is watching. Of course, then it's the age verification, because it has been shown in the past where companies who have been in charge of age verification have lost the credentials, because the information that we are given obviously is, you know, it's top class for hackers, again, that you're showing your IDs and they would have a clean data set for future things as well. But because there are other things you can do, again, so in other words, if an account was created, you know, 20 years ago, 18 years ago, and the person is trying to log in on X, that proves literally that they are. They also can tell from other email providers what age they are. They can also look at the followers that some young person is, and the media, actually, even, that has been shared. So there are ways of being able to estimate someone's age to a large extent.
But there are, everything you mentioned, there are easy workarounds in that. The one thing I don't get fundamentally is that, you know, and you've referenced this, Up to 15% of the content uploaded to X is pornography, which is a huge proportion of its traffic. Some estimates 1 in 8 or a little bit more of the uploads to X is pornography. And I don't know how that might then equate in terms of the user traffic that's accessing that. And it sits within sort of the X space where people 16 can sign up to legally. I don't understand how anyone under the age of 18 could be allowed to sign up to a social media provider that contains so much pornography.
I hadn't seen that number. I mean, that seems high. Like I said, I'm hours a day on X. It's the only social media.
Yes, but it's ring fenced. It's incredible. But that is this. Well, you can search it. You can check it out yourself. The studies are out there. It's 12 to 15% of uploaded content X is pornography. Yeah, but they ring fence it in a way whereby they have it driving the traffic. It's like the videotape industry, right? Yeah. They have it driving the traffic and driving the usage. They don't monetize it. You're not allowed to monetize it. But it's puts a huge base of traffic in there for X.
It does, again, so it's down to age assurance, whether or not, because, of course, a user, you know, would you sign up to X to see porn? That would be unusual, where it's only a Google search away to watch any of this in that case. So the problem, again, well, not the problem, but there's a worry here about, you know, and the wider issue about censorship, because X is different than most platforms. Again, it's predominantly male, it's a younger audience as well, but it's for news, it's for breaking stories as well. And it's not that I wouldn't welcome it, because there's so much of the content on there, which is so annoying, of course. It depends on your viewpoint in any subject, but people can hide behind anonymous accounts, and that can be very annoying. Whereas in the ideal world, everyone would have to have their profile verified and then stand up for what they say. On the other hand, there's a lot of information we might not get, a lot of whistleblown if people weren't able to use anonymous accounts in that case as well. So it's whether or not one could argue that X is kind of in a different space because of the nature of it for breaking news, and it's a political platform. And you know, whether it appeals to young people in general, this, you know, generally it's not where they go. It'd be unusual, you know, for... Yeah. It's not a mass audience when it comes to young people, but in other words, that. But again, no one wants to say that the social media sites have got away with so much. I mean, most of the other social media sites I would ban tomorrow. Personally, I don't see any value in Instagram. I just think it adds to insecurity among young people. is driven by, you know, the user engagement algorithm. Even if no one maliciously is there rubbing their hands behind the scenes, it just goes by itself to monetize content, which is just awful again. So no problem with that. Facebook, again, that they'll shove anything out there. There's nothing to be gained by being on social media for most young people. X is a little different because you will see stories there that the mainstream media will not cover. You will see stories from the sides that both sides of the argument.
I agree with you, but I would find Telegram now a far more useful source for reporting, and a lot of the reporting that I find useful on X sourced from Telegram. But you see, the thing is your user experience is completely different to mine. It's not even a debate that can be had, because someone listening, their user experience is completely different again. So I need to maybe get into your algorithm and it'll be more useful for me. A pleasure as always, Kevin. Thank you so very much indeed. Professor Kevin Curran there. We're being told of a split emerging among defence listeners, with some returning to Criminal Legal Aid panel. You will know that there is an ongoing tete-a-tete between the Law Society and Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan over the introduction of a new flat fee payment model. Now we're joined by Rory O'Brien, Principal of McIntyre's and O'Brien Solicitors Letterkenny. Rory, is there a split emerging?
I don't believe there is, Greg. There is some media reports that there are certain district court areas in the country where some solicitors have returned to work since the 1st of September. But to put it in context, the numbers that seem to suggest were from the Irish Independent this morning. I think there were about 35 or 36 solicitors. To give it context, there were probably about 10 solicitors who'd never engaged in any withdrawal of services since this dispute arose in mid-June. There's probably about 25 of those that have returned, and to put it in context, 35 against 600 per individuals who are on the panel. That's approximately 5%. So 95% of solicitors are still engaged in withdrawal services throughout the country.
29 were issued at district courts in Waterford, 20 in Limerick, 16 in Carlow, 16 in Clonmel, 11 in Kilkenny, 9 in Naas, 8 in Portlaoise, 7 in Wexford, 1 in Nenagh. When you look at the overall pool there, that's relatively small.
I would agree. And if we wanted to look at it in the context, I'm not sure if you have the figures from Donegal, Greg, in terms of the certificates issued last year. Do you have those figures?
I'm no, sure I don't. Did. I'd be glad.
You'd be delighted to hear them. Yeah, absolutely. Last year, during July 2025, in the two district court offices, which is both Donegal Town and Letterkenny, in Donegal Town last year, in July 2025, 32 certificates issued. In July of this year, none. Mm. In Letterkenny last year, 183. In July of this year, none.
There's obviously a bit of a battle for the public minds going on here as well, and even the minds of some within the Law Society. That's what's happening, and we see it all the time: divide and conquer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a matter for the minister how he wants to approach this. We have been very united and unified as an organisation. In terms of any solicitors who have returned, it should note that if they have returned, they've returned since September. Again, I think it's less than 5%, if even that. And as I said, if you take away the 10, it's even less than that. So 95% of solicitors, and again, the larger urban population areas, Dublin, Cork, Galway, none of those have returned. Nobody in Donegal has returned. And, you know, we keep in contact with each other, and we ask, and we're aware there are certain court areas where judiciary can be a little bit more strident in their tone, shall I say. We have been very supported and very appreciative of the support and cooperation we've received from the judiciary in Donegal, the Gardaí, and everyone who's become aware of the situation and how this dispute has unfolded and what's being asked of us in the scenarios.
Everyone wants to be back at work doing the jobs that they love, right? So the Law Society has asked the Justice Minister, which seems reasonable, to consider the appointment of an independent mediator. So that is someone independent of the Law Society, independent of the Minister, that looks at where we're at and tries to come up with a solution. Why do you believe the Justice Minister has resisted that proposal up until now? Or maybe it's not been on the table long enough for you.
It hasn't been on the table before. The Law Society have been constant in their message that the door is open. We can discuss the two core issues that we need to resolve. are different certificates for different types of work and for different types of cases. And what's being asked of us, just to give it context for your listeners, Greg, analogies are always good to understand what the issues we're facing. Where we are is you're being asked, like a mechanic, I'm sure the mechanic's listening. A mechanic is being asked to deal with a customer who comes in with one car and it's fixed in 5 minutes, and that's your flat rate fee. And you might say, well, that's great. Well done. We're being asked effectively to be the mechanics. Somebody could come in with 20 cars and it's the same fee and could take months upon end to resolve. And it's the same thing. So that's really where the nub of the issue is for us in terms of what's being asked, in terms of the functioning of the system, which we say is no way effective. It's no way a proper way to administer justice for any individuals. The suggestion and proposal of the mediator has come from the Law Society only as of last night, is my understanding. But as I was saying, they've had the door open. They've been keen to engage. Letters upon letters have been written by the Law Society to the Department of Justice. And we're hopeful that the minister will engage in this process and allow us to get back to work to do what we want to do and help people as best we can.
Yeah, and I don't want to be cynical, but I suspect that Minister O'Callaghan wants this resolved.
And the
Law
certainly agree
Society
with
is pretty resolute. He's making some decent political headway in the area of immigration, migration. The public actually aren't that bothered about this unless you're directly affected by it. I don't mean that badly, but they're not. And there's not any political value in him holding out here too much in this regard. So I suspect that there'll be a resolution sooner rather than later.
I hope you're right, Greg, and I'll just make this point. It's interesting you say the public aren't two-minded. And in my experience, anytime someone does come into the criminal justice system, it's a real eye opener.
Oh yes, no doubt. Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean that. Whatever way you come into it, people are always surprised and amazed at how it operates. And people who perhaps would be a little bit cynical about criminal defense work and the type of individuals that
quick
might find
education.
With it, yeah, it's a good education. And 90% of the time, I think people come away with it with a little bit more nuanced view of how it works and a little bit more sympathetic for all of the players that are involved in the system.
I can imagine. Rory, great to have access to you, by the way, to get the insight from a legal perspective. Rory O'Brien there, who's principal of McIntyre O'Brien, solicitors, Letterkenny. Commenter on YouTube. Hi, Greg. Just saw someone on an e-scooter travelling on the new Active Travel at Ballyrain. They had high vis and a helmet, but also had a backpack on their back. Should this person have been reported? Well, I mean, I wouldn't personally. I think carrying a backpack's a bit harsh, personally speaking, like if it's an over the shoulder on the back because people, to and from the shops or school, I suppose, maybe they're trying to actually just eliminate the functional use for e-scooters before there's an all right ban. So it's up to you. It depends the type of person you are. Would it be me? I wouldn't. I mean, it's probably a minor infraction, but as I say, it's up to you. Could you? You could, of course. Should you? That's a personal decision. A caller says, you think children are confused coming out of school now? Wait till you see what's it's going to be like with all the woke nonsense that they're being taught in national school. Mum and dad will not be able to deal with it. Well, a lot of that stuff, the kids are already through that and coming out, and into the secondary schools and what have you. So that's nothing new. A lot of that stuff's not new. A lot of it's being highlighted by certain groups, but it's not new. Now, Dr. Mary McAleese says she's devastated and feels momentum for integration is fading after confirming that she stepped down as chairperson of the Integration Committee overseeing the amalgamation of the GEA, the LGFA and Camogie Association. It comes after the GEA told the steering group that it could not commit to the definitive timeline for integration. We're going to get some reaction to this. Firstly, to Mary Coughlan, chairperson of Donegal GAA. Mary, good morning to you. Thanks so much for your time. And just your reaction I suppose, Ms. McAleese's decision, but also, the fact that she's done it in a really high-profile way. She wanted the public to know what she felt.
Well, look, we are disappointed. The reality is Mary McAleese is a very high-profile person herself because she's a former president of Ireland. But I think people need to take a little bit of stock and a bit of time here. This is not saying that integration is not going to take place. It is saying that the time frame for it is too quick. And it is very obvious that in any conversations I had with colleagues all over the country, following the meetings that we had, the last one we had was with Ulster and Gervahi, that people were uncomfortable that there was a diktat there and that things had to be done by next year, which would have meant, for example, just to make it clear, we would have our convention at the end of December, and at that convention there would be a new structure if things were passed at special Congress. So you would have one chairperson of three codes, two vice chair, one secretary, one treasurer. I knew in my heart and soul this was not going to get through special Congress, because a voluntary organisation has to take the people with them. And it is important to note that in the main, all over the country, people were not at idem with what was trying to be achieved. They are not against the principle, nor I. And I just spoke to my colleague in the LGFA. We will still continue to work with the LGFA and the Camogues. We have an integration committee in Donegal. We were the first probably in the country to have it. We're very lucky that we have the one club model. And before somebody blows up your telephones there, it isn't perfect.
Mm. Okay.
But people are trying to work towards it.
Mary, I'll come
so
back
I
to you.
I think it's the time frame. Yeah. The philosophy is correct. The time frame is the problem.
Okay, I'll come back to you in a moment. Lynn Savage is chief executive of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association. Lynn, sorry, I know you're, as Mary, both very busy people. But just a brief comment from you in relation to, I suppose, the work heretofore of Dr. McAleese and her decision and comments.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. And I suppose first and foremost, we want to thank, as our statement says, Dr. McAleese for her leadership and her dedication to this, and certainly wish her every success going forward. I do think she's had a contribution in bringing the three organisations to the table, especially on something of this scale. But for all of us now, we know we were surprised. We had a meeting on Monday. It was constructive. And we had next steps. We have a date in for the next meeting in October. We have a date, the three CEOs to meet prior to that. So to us, this certainly isn't finished. And going on Mary's piece there, there's still a huge commitment that this is going to be done. This is what has to happen for our members. So we need to take the time now to reflect on that and focus firmly on what comes next. So our energy very much has to go into moving forward, and I suppose not speculating about setbacks, etc., but bringing all the great work that has been done and driving that forward now has to be the key.
Mm. So with that in mind, do you think some of that progress was undone, with as much respect as you might have for Dr. McAleese, with her parting shots?
No, I honestly don't believe it was, and I can understand there can be frustrations as well. I mean, there's frustrations on all sides at times. We'd all love everything to happen at the click of our fingers and to drive things forward. But it is a massive thing. Like, when we come together, we're looking at approximately 1.2 million members. And it's not just structures, it's funding, it's facilities and everything. I think what's very important to note is, like, currently, every evening of the week, every day of the week, males and females, all four codes plus handball and rounders, we're all currently playing on all those facilities. Mm. So facilities is not something that we need to make sure is there for this to happen. It's not. There's certain things that are there that are ready. We're well away. We have membership pretty much ready. And there's these final pieces around making sure the structure is right, on especially on Mary's point there as well. But we need to make sure we have all that in a place where everybody knows this can work and drive it forward. So I don't think the work will be undone. I think there's actually more of an onus on us now. Our members have asked for this. We want to drive it forward, and I'm very confident that we will.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Lynn. Lynn Savage, Chief Executive Officer of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association. And back to you, Mary, as well. Mary McAleese expressed shock that GA President Jarlath Burns, as she says, backed away from full integration in favour of a looser federation model. Is that goes a little bit beyond timelines? You know, we can't get it over the line by 2027, and more into the space of actually something very different.
What would happen is, if we had special Congress, it would have been lost.
Mm.
And that would have been a retrograde step. And I think people have to realise this is a voluntary organisation. People also have to realise that it's all about working together, and there has to be flexibility, and you can't have silos. So you are dealing with attitudinal change as well as structural change. And what has happened is, and what's great, is we have seen our organisations grow and develop.
Mm.
Like, 100 years ago, you might have one football team. Mm-hmm. You never had children. Now you have all of that underage, Kostya, et cetera, et cetera. The same in hurling. Now, ladies football has grown and developed very much in my view. And now we have seen them entering more competitions under 20, et cetera. And it'll mirror exactly what's happening in the boys' games. The same with hurling, and Camogie isn't necessarily as strong here because football is stronger, but it's still a huge part of the culture that we have here. So, you know, there are issues about membership. You know, one of the bugbears for a lot of people is if you are a member of a club, for example, and then you join the LGFA to play, to be insured to play, it costs more money. So is there a way, you know, there's low hanging fruit there that makes life a wee bit easier for people. And the reality is, and I know it's all codes, I'm sure if you spoke to the soccer people and the rugby people and the basketball people, having volunteers is very difficult. If you're going to inundate volunteers with more work, you definitely not have an organisation. So you have to have reality. And for the Uachtaráin, he was acutely aware. He's a very smart man. He is acutely aware that this would not go through our special Congress. I can't speak for the LGA or Camogie, but there are certain things that can be done that will work very well. Membership, insurance, you know, trying to work out fixtures. Like, it's very difficult. I'm chair of Donegal GA, so I like to go to as many games as I can.
Yeah.
So if our men, senior men, are playing against Dublin at a weekend, the next thing, the ladies are playing in Clare at the same time. So you can't even get to the game. Mm. So, you know, and anybody that's a fixture secretary is pulling out their hair at the best of times trying to get things sorted. So it's going to take time, but there has to be flexibility. And I suppose when you're starting an organisation, you like to look after your own patch. But we have matured within over the last 100 plus years in the GAA that can work. And, you know, they're, unlike here, we only have one specific hurling club and one Camogie club. Down the country, they have hurling clubs, ladies, you know. So it's going to take them time to pull together and to be of one organisation. And, you know, I think it's important to say, like, I listened to Tom Parsons there from the GPA. You think this was all gone. It's not all gone.
Mm-hmm. How did we arrive at this tight deadline, Mary? Because that seems to be the issue here. How did we find ourselves agreeing to such a tight deadline that's sort of created, you know, this scenario we're in now, rather than, as I can understand, massive organisations that are so alike and so different at the same time. It takes a long time for any sort of amalgamation. I think most people might get that because it's like trying to herd cats at time as well organised as they are, right? So how did we arrive with this really tight deadline that left the chair, left the head of the GA having to say, look, this is not going to go through Congress. There needs more time. There needs more conversation.
Well, if you don't have a timeline, that'll be mañana. You know that yourself. If you don't have something to work towards. And there has been a huge amount of work done on, you know, and Micheál Nocton did speak there as a former Uachtaráin, very involved. I see him running to meetings and doing all that. But you have to bring everybody with you. And for some people, they're a little bit lost as to what this will actually look like. And, you know, if you took it in practical terms, if you have one person chair of the three organisations in Donegal, now I know the work involved in my position, and I know what Joanne and Mary have to do in their positions. So, you know, you have to be realistic as to how this would work, that whatever has to be done, like anybody who's a secretary or treasurer, the huge amount of work that's involved, and then representation and Ulster and all the rest. You know, we have created an organisation that is massive. It is also a democratically elected organisation. And we mustn't forget that people who are members in the clubs are at the end of the day the people that decide who are going to be their representatives, who's going to be the Uachtaráin, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, people need to cool the jets a little bit here. Let's look at, as that lady said, let's look at the frameworks, let's get the membership sorted, maybe look at the insurance, let's see if that can happen. And, like, the financial constraints on everybody is massive because there's all sorts of things that have to be done, health and safety, child protection. You know, all of those things are day-to-day things that have to be looked after by clubs, and at you know, it filters all the way through. And at the end of the day, what do we want? What do we want in the GAA? What do we want in the LGFA? And what do we want in Camogie? We want children and adults to enjoy playing games and enjoying the opportunity to see them.
Yeah, what do you think of her?
We forget this is a sporting organization.
Yeah, yeah,
this is supposed
course.
To be a pastime because our people
it doesn't feel
are
like
not
it.
Paid.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, in terms of equality and women's place and respect, for, it's clearly very important to Mary McAleese. And maybe some watching on might think that she was a little bit blinded by that, as though her heart might be in her right place. That sometimes it takes time. I just want a quick word from you, if you don't mind, in relation to her resistance to female leadership. I'm speaking to you as the head of the GAA here. We've got some powerful women in very strong positions in this county and also nationally as well. It was hard won, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of women in positions of influence within the organisation. So do you think her comments, whilst perhaps well meant, that the GAA management and certain senior figures and certain management members block progress because they do not want women making decisions at the top level of Gaelic sports. Do you think that's in a way kind of done the likes of yourself and others, even on the Central Council, a disservice?
You look at Donegal, the three main officers in Donegal GAA are three women. We probably have more women elected to our county board than county management than probably anybody. The three leaders of the three codes in Donegal are three women. So we're probably unique.
Mm.
And it's very disappointing that there's only two women who are chairs, myself and Maureen in Down. There are owl fogies out there that do not want to see anybody go anywhere, regardless of being men or women. But you have to expect and respect the fact that, you know, they have a perspective. And without a doubt, I don't see that as a reality. You have to work with people. You have to work on the ground within your own organisation. And you can't expect to be elected to any position, regardless of your male or female, unless you do that hard work. So I do respect the fact that Mary, was president. She found it difficult enough to get elected previously as a politician. She's a very fine public representative, a very fine leader, as without a doubt. I suppose her expectation, a bit like my own, is it's a pity we're still talking about this. You know, the same in politics, it's the same in business. But if you start yamming and crying about everything all the time, nobody is going to listen. You have to get up and do something about it. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to do that in Donegal. We're going to get up. We're going to work closely as best possible within our own organisation and, get rid of these ideas of silos. Let's work together for the betterment and to leave a legacy behind when you're elected of something being better than when you started.
Oh.
And, you know, the Uachtaráin wants that, our own Uachtaráin, and I'm sure the Uachtaráins of the other organisations and codes likewise. So it will be, it's a disappointment, definitely, huge amount of work done by Mary and her committee. Don't lest we forget there is a committee there. So, you know, as long as we can move on with the recommendations, get some of these practical things sorted, work with the government in trying to develop more women in sport and more children in sport, which is equally as important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, listen, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. That's the chair of the Donegal GAA, Mary Coughlan. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Now, we are joined on the programme by Bernie Thompson, Secretary of St. Joseph's Community Hospital. Good morning to you, Bernie.
Oh, good morning, Greg.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's good.
Just want to clarify, I'm Secretary of the St. Joseph's Action Group.
Yeah, I was thinking that the name had changed, you know. Anyway, what hasn't changed is the news Facebook page name yet, which is good. The St. Joseph's Bus Fund. Now, remind me, because we talked about this, either to you or a colleague of yours some time ago, and I thought someone would step in, particularly maybe a business or something, and get this over the line. So what is this news Facebook page looking to raise awareness and funds for, Bernie?
Well, the Facebook page is looking to raise funds for the new St. Joseph's patients bus. So the last time we spoke was about holding a public meeting just to get a group of people together.
That's right.
To start driving the effort to raise the funds. So now we've achieved that. So now we're just really kicking off the fundraising effort, which has already sort of taken legs before we've even started. So what we're doing now is starting the drive to raise the money towards the bus fund. So we're just highlighting the cause and just reaching out to the community and asking them for all their help and any assistance and any fundraising ideas, and to come along and support us in any of our nights that and events that we're holding.
Right, and they'll all be listed on the Facebook page, so that makes it a good one-stop shop. So the idea is to raise funds for a 12-seater wheelchair accessible bus, and this will be used by patients and relatives as well. For what kind of stuff will this bus allow hospital to do?
Well, the bus itself is going to be like, it's really a vehicle for independence. So it's going to allow them to have days out to attend community events, to go on trips, to social events, and I suppose even like ad hoc activities, you know, if patients need to attend funerals of friends or relatives or anything like that. And then on another important level, it allows friends and patients and residents and their friends and loved ones to attend events or be together outside of walls of the hospital and to see each other outside of the confines of the hospital walls. And then it allows them to, I mean, they've been a big part of the community all of their life. So it allows them to remain connected to the community that they've been so vital to all of their lives.
So what is the plan? Is it to acquire a new bus, get it adapted, or what is the plan, Bernie?
There's several options, but the main plan that we're looking at is to acquire a brand new bus. I believe that when you do get a bus, the bus kind of comes, it's the outer shell of the bus, and then you get the bus spec'd to as you need. So what we're actually hoping to do is to get either a 12 or 14 seater bus that is going to be wheelchair accessible. So just depending on the number of patients or, you know, whatever the particular need is on that occasion, that we're able to facilitate it at that time.
And what's the estimated cost? What's the target?
The target at the moment is 100,000. So at the moment, the Patients Comfort Fund has kindly donated 20,000 towards that. So we are aiming to make up the shortfall then of the 80,000.
Which should be so doable. We're so incredibly generous. This would be a bus too. Do you know what's important about it too? It's for people to get out and about with their families and to live life, but also to be seen as well too. You know what I mean? And it's such a fantastic facility. And there was so much goodwill went into the fight to retain St. Joseph's or enhance it or to have it there for the... It just should be 80-odd grand, whatever it be. It should be really achievable, you know, with the fantastic generosity that's out there, Bernie.
It's already taken legs. We have people who've already started making donations at our iDonate page. People have been making donations in the admin office at St. Joseph. Mm-hmm. We've had a wonderful €1,000 donation from the Harley family from the Kim's Colour Fun Run. We've had a €500 donation from the credit union. The McBride's Ride Out for Don Carroll held a collection for us. We haven't counted that yet. And then this Friday night, actually, at the Navney Street Reunion Celebration Party, they are going to be very kindly presenting us with a donation towards the Patients Bus Fund. So we're delighted with that. And then next week, our own events that we've just started off scheduling, we have just the quiz night in the Balbofane Snorler Golf Club on the 16th. And then on the 2nd of October, we have a wonderful night It's called A Night to Remember. It's been driven by one of the people on our fundraising committee called Stephanie Hannigan. Mm. Her dad is actually in St. Joseph's, so she has written a beautiful song about him, and she's going to debut that at the event. And then we're also going to have a lot of other wonderful local talent there on the night. So that's going to be fantastic. And then if people want to help out, they can like the Facebook page. All the details are on there. You'll see all the I Donate details. They can go direct to St. Joseph's. You'll start to see our posters dotted about the place more and more. We have a QR code on that people can just use their phones and donate directly onto the page. And then another thing, actually, if people want to donate, we're always looking for prizes for raffles and things like that, because we'll be having raffles at, the quiz night at the night in the Baller. Yeah, because the prizes tend to translate into lots of fun. So then we can use them in ongoing raffles, because obviously we're going to be at this for a while.
Okay.
And then I suppose the other thing we really encourage that is if people think of us in their own fundraising efforts. I know lots of times people want to do something for charity. So if they want to think of us, then if they have an idea or if they want to contact us, and we will get in touch with them and fully support them.
All right, Bernie, what's the name of the Facebook page again?
It's called the St. Joseph's Patient Bus Fund.
Okay, well done, Bernie. You're a great advocate. Thank you so much for your time. Great to see it progressing so well.
All right. Thank you so much,
Greg. Bye-bye, and let us know if we can help in any way. Okay, Bernie Thompson there, secretary of the organisation, which I had the wrong one written in front of me. By the way, we have a fantastic... it's not even a competition. It's like an open draw running on our website, highlandradio.com. It was launched on Lee Gooch's show there earlier this week, and already it's had a huge reaction. It doesn't surprise me at all, because it's the chance to win a trip to Lapland. And it's everything included. You literally could go with an empty wallet, and it's in association with our friends at Atlantic Travel. So it's a trip to Lapland for a family of four, and everything that you'd expect to be included is included, and it's free to enter. So all you have to do is go onto our website and you'll see the link, and you can enter there. And it's an open draw then. You've about, let's see how long, a couple of weeks left to enter that. So get on if you can. Not often you get something for free, absolutely free, but that is. So as I say, check it out. Let's get to some of your comments here now. Greg, Mayor McAleese is an attention seeker. If she doesn't get her own way, just like a child throwing a tantrum. I'm sure her heart's in the right place, but that's your view. Mary Coughlin speaks well. This takes time. Anything rushed through is never good in the long run. Another, Mary Coughlin and Lynn have a sensible approach to the GEA issue of the moment. These two ladies can bring it forward amicably. Mary McAleese is too full of her own importance and thinks everyone should drop tools and do exactly as she says and thinks. Now, she was part of, you know, three organisations agreed a 2027 timeline. So let's not forget about that either. So she didn't just pull this out of the air herself. And I'm sure her and the committee put an awful lot of work into it. I'd say her heart's in the right place. But the caller goes on to say, Mary Coughlin's line, try to bring everyone with you, will win the race at the end of the day. Slow and steady wins the race, says that caller. The LGFA in Donegal have to pay for these their services in convoy to the men's code. This is all about money. The GEA purse right down to clubs will have to go further, and some people don't want that. On the issue of fuel, I think that there's a lot of lazy journalists in the world. Greg was talking about the price of diesel. He made a throwaway comment. Trump has pushed us into a corner, and that's why we're paying high prices. A barrel of crude oil is $100. Petrol at the pumps is €2. In 2008, oil was €140 a barrel. We were paying €1.45 on average at the pumps. How can we be expected to pay these prices when crude oil is actually now cheaper than 2008, but the fuel at the pumps is higher in price? If the media accepts this, we'll be forced to pay these prices. There's a lot of variables in that, by the way, and it's the retail price. You know, you're missing out a whole plethora of stuff in between oil coming out of the ground and it ended up at the petrol pumps. There's the retail price and everything. And also to you obviously then understand the complexities of how all of this might work. I'll address that in more detail when I get an opportunity. And I don't want to do it off the top of my head because it's an important point. And I do like to address criticism to read it out. And if there's a counter argument to bring that forward. Greg, what are the pros and cons of having smart electric meters installed, thinking of rejecting it? The bottom line is you can reject it now. If it breaks down, eventually they're going to say to you, look, there's no spare parts for your meter. We're going to have to put in the smart meter. I personally don't think it's a tide you can resist. What are the advantages? You know, the electricity you're using as you go, potentially you can go for particular plans that might be more advantageous to the way you use electricity. I'm not an advocate for it or an objector to it. I just say stick it in because I know for a fact that if your meter starts playing up your old meter, they're not going to be able to repair it. You're going to end up with a smart meter eventually. Everyone is, unless you've got one of these smart meters that lasts for, these old meters that lasts forever. You think children are confused coming out of school now? Wait till you see what's going to be like with all this woke nonsense. I read that one earlier. I personally hate this point system. They aren't given too many bonus points. And believe you and me, unless you're a top student, it's difficult to see it all of the time. And that caller works in a school. Right, let's go to Minister Neil Richmond, Minister of State for International Development and Diaspora. We're talking in the context of a new report that shows Ireland's impact and values and actions in 2025. Ireland's continued financial support has helped save lives, protected human dignity and build better futures. Good morning, Minister. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Can I ask you first off, because we've donated $807 million in overseas development aid last year. Now, anytime we sort of get new stats about poverty that we got this week, the cost of living, people will always text in, if we weren't sending all this money abroad, we'd be able to look after our own. Now, that's clunky phraseology, and they don't mean it in a sort of a far right way or anything like that. There, people often just say, how can we be sending so much money abroad when we've got so many problems to fix at home? So before we start, because those texts are going to come in inevitably again, Minister, just explain to me that it's not even a juxtaposition, is it? But that scenario about sending money away when we've got 200,000 children living in poverty here.
Well, perfectly valid and understandable questions, and a question I actually welcome. And there's two things I'd say to it. First and foremost, you have to think about the amount of money that's being spent. So €807 million for a huge overseas development assistance program is probably equivalent of 8-9 months worth of the current fuel subsidy that we have at the pump. So it's not this huge amount that is going to cure all the very many ills that we find in society. But secondly, how many of the issues that we regularly talk about are the ones that actually stem from this level of global inequality, mass irregular migration, food insecurity, energy insecurity, the spread of disease, global terrorism, all of that comes from the level of global inequality that we see. Last year, for example, one of the African countries most hit by European aid cuts was Mali. Do you know the nationality of the largest amount of asylum seekers coming into Europe last year? They were also from Mali. So when we talk about these issues at home, which are regular issues, which are absolutely part of our common discourse, we go, well, where do these stem from at source? And when we talk about disruption to the Straits of Hormuz and how that's having impact on fuel and food, we go back to the level of disruption from Houthi rebels in Yemen shooting in due to mass poverty. We talk about the piracy off the coast of Somalia and Sudan. And these sound like really big macro geopolitical issues, but they all have a massive impact at home. So this isn't charity. This isn't spending money elsewhere rather than spending at home. It's actually addressing the issues that we face at source. A really stark fact, because even though Ireland has maintained its aid budget, so many other countries haven't. 23.1% of the world's ODA has reduced due to the decisions of President Trump. We would be of a generation where we remember the really scary tales of the HIV/AIDS pandemic going across the 80s and the 90s, the scary advertisements. For the last 25 years, HIV/AIDS infections globally have been going down. Last year, for the first time in 25 years, they've gone up due to aid cuts by other countries. So that will have a consequence, not just in the poorest countries, but also here in Ireland.
We've seen in the United States that it can be politically popular to cut foreign aid, but it's not without consequence. And we're, I think you outlined, we're one of the few countries that maintains or increases the overseas aid, but it does have every euro, every dollar that is not sent abroad, there are actual real life consequences.
Absolutely. The cuts that we've seen over the last year or two have been devastating. People have died. As I said, HIV/AIDS rates have gone up, malaria infection rates have gone up, child marriage has gone up, the level of female genital mutilation has gone up. That instability has forced more people to try and cross the Sahara and in due course cross the Mediterranean and rubber raft to come to Europe to seek solace. I think also one of the really stark aspects that we don't talk about is that 73% of the Irish population support ODA, but yet are we going to allow the agenda be driven by the 12% or the in-between gap, who 12% who oppose it, or the 10 or so who aren't too sure? Those who shout the loudest aren't necessarily the exact reflection of the mood on the ground. We have support for this in Ireland. We have a great history going back to our missionary partners and our charities and our aid agencies over the years, the likes of Golden Troker and Concern, that are so wedded to so many of our childhood psyches growing up. So we have a real big opportunity and responsibility now to not only maintain our budget, but to push back against the minority that are simply following the American example at the moment.
And listen, no offence to you as a government representative, and it's up to people. I don't try and influence people one way or other. They can make up their own minds. But the truth is if we didn't spend this $807 million, it doesn't mean that there are no more, because government decides what to do with money and we have a significant excess, right? It doesn't mean that we have an SNA in every school. It doesn't, or as many as we need. It doesn't mean hospital waiting lists are eliminated. It is not an either or. With the right will, and I'm sure you'd argue the efforts are being made in that regard, we actually do have the resources, as well as sending this money away, to fix most of the problems that we have in this country. And as I say, you'd probably argue that work's ongoing. So as I say, really the critical thing is what I try and say to listeners. It is not you take $807 million away from overseas development aid and all of a sudden it improves lives of people here per se.
Next month on the 6th of October, Simon Harris will deliver a budget that will be the biggest budget in the history of this state. And this isn't some political, you know, aren't we great? Ultimately, the resources are there. Now, there's obviously issues in terms of implementation. There's obviously, we'd look to have more resources. But if we were to cut our aid budget to take out $100 million here or even abolish it altogether, it won't solve all the very many challenges that a society like ours faces, but it could be devastating for not only some of the poorest countries in the world, but it would lead to a greater increase in our own country. So we'd actually be creating more problems that ultimately we'd have to spend even more money on down the road in Ireland.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much, Minister Neil Richmond. He's Minister of State for International Development and Diaspora. And have your say in relation to that, by the way. You know, I mean, if you take it down to the household level, we're the most generous county in the country for giving. And people make a decision in their homes every single day whether or not to, so say you've got 10 euro, do you donate 1 euro and 50 cent to the St. Joseph's Bus campaign? Some people might decide to do that because they'll say, you know what, that's the right thing to do and it leaves me with 850. And I suppose as a state, as a country, you elect people and they make that decision for you. Do you agree or disagree? 807 million euro. As I say, you know, there is plenty of wiggle room in this country to fix most of the woes. The political will, Minister Richmond would argue, is there. But you know yourself, people are feeling it on the ground and don't sometimes get a sense that that's the case. But there you go. International aid sector overall down 23%. Denmark maintained theirs. Ireland and Spain are the only EU countries to increase their aid budget. Everyone else cut their aid budget. So anyway, those are variations of the facts. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Have your say. Like, do you genuinely think we shouldn't be sending that money away? And if so, what do you think that 807 million should be spent on? Or are you part of the majority that Minister Richmond referenced there and you think that, look, we've always been a generous giving country? if we help support people in their own countries, arguably they're less likely to have to flee disease, flee climate, flee oppression, etc. What do you think? Just time for a very quick one, and it's not Councillor Jimmy Brogan's fault, it's ours, Cathaoirleach of the Donegal Municipal District. Another survey, another sad set of statistics, focusing this time, Jimmy, on Frosses National School. What did the stats tell us?
Yeah, good morning, Greg. Yeah, well, the we've been to the council for a long time now to put up some more signage, you know, to slow traffic down coming into the village of Frosses, especially from the Glenties side. So the council conducted a speed survey over 2 weeks or nearly 2 weeks in July, and they found, like, listen, startling really. Well, there was about over 28,000 vehicles passed in that 2 week period. But what they found really was that 41% of the vehicles were speeding, were over the 50 kilometre per hour speed limit, and there was actually one car detected was travelling at 78 kilometres per hour. Like, you know, so listen, the parents, especially the parents of the school in Frosses, are keen to get some more signage up, especially and finally, that shows the vehicles.
Just briefly, Jimmy, how much of these problems with this school and others on our main roads are these issues going to be addressed as part of the review of speed limits?
Well, the speed limit will go down to 30 kilometres per hour, but well, this traffic survey shows that people aren't obeying the speed limit at the minute. Yeah, so just because you change the speed limit doesn't mean people are going to obey it once it's changed. You know? So I think it's important that everything we can do to slow the traffic down is done. Like, you know? So as well as the school, there's also, you know, there's a community centre there in Frosses with a tennis court and a basketball court, and there's coffee well there, like, you know, just beside the school. So, and a couple of wee shops. And so it's important that we do everything we can really to slow the traffic down.
It is a brilliant part of the world. Thanks, Jimmy. Councillor Jimmy Brogan, Cathaoirleach of the Donegal Municipal District. Back tomorrow morning at 9.